Let's go to our weekly New Zealand crime feature. And today we're looking at the case of Gail Maney, whose story was detailed in an award-winning podcast called Gone Fishing. That podcast was a joint effort between Stuff and RNZ. But just in case you, like me, don't have time in your life for podcasts, we'll give you the short version now. Since that podcast was published, Gail Maney has, so the podcast outlined Gail's two trials and a conviction for the murder of Dean Fuller Sandys. And since the podcast was published, Gail Maney's been recalled to prison. And so that's put more impetus on the private investigator, Tim McKinnell, to uncover the evidence that might prove her innocence beyond doubt. Tim's with me in the Auckland studio. Hi.
Hi, Jesse.
So let's start with the disappearance of Dean Fuller Sandys. What happened?
In August 1989, he packed up his car. He told a few people that he was heading out fishing. He said goodbye to his family. He had fishing rods in his car. He drove out to West Auckland. He had indicated to some people that he was heading to Whatapu, right out at the Manukau Heads. He was never seen again, if you accept one version of events. It was believed at that time by and for the following 7 or 8 years that he had disappeared off the rocks, been swept off the rocks while fishing.
They found his car, his rods, that sort of thing?
They found his car out at Whatapu, and there was some equipment that was found in 1989 that was recognised as equipment belonging to him at the high tide mark.
Okay. So case closed.
Certainly for the following 7 or 8 years, it was considered that was what had happened to him, both by the police and many other people.
Okay. And so before we jump ahead to 1997, we should also mention another murder that took place in August 1989. And the link will become clearer later, but tell me about, is it Leah Stevens?
Leah Stevens, that's right. So just a few days later, less than a week later, Leah disappeared from Queen Street. She was working as a prostitute at the time. She disappeared and nobody knew what happened to her. It was reported to police a few days later, but it wasn't until her body was found in the forest in West Auckland in 1992 that it was confirmed that it had been a murder.
Okay. So what's the next part in the story?
Well, from 1992, there was an investigation. The police reinvigorated their search for evidence around what had happened to Leah, but it came to...
So that's when they found her body. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. So there was an investigation. It went on for 3 or 4 months, and it didn't really come to much. Not too much else happened over the following 3 or 4 years, but by 1997 there was rumours starting to circulate in the West Auckland community about the potential murder of an unknown person. A man had supposedly been killed in West Auckland, and it really was little more than rumours, gossip and speculation. But the police got wind of this, and as part of the information they'd received, they'd been told that a person by the name of Stephen Stone had been involved. The police were particularly interested in him at the time. He had an extensive criminal history. And so they began a series of operations trying to work out who it might have been that had been killed. One of the names that popped up in the course of that work was Dean Fuller Sand's name. He'd gone missing and his body hadn't been found. And so his name was thrown into the mix as a potential victim of this supposed homicide.
By the way, if you accept explanation A, that he was washed off the rocks fishing, would it have been unusual that his body wasn't found?
Not particularly unusual, no. And so this was the focus of some of the evidence at trial. But it certainly, when people are swept off the rocks there and other places, the body recovery rate is far from 100%.
Okay. And does it happen? Do people get swept off the rocks there?
Yeah, it's a dangerous beach. And that particular night in August 1989, it was a spring tide and it was rough weather.
Okay. So back to the police in 1997, who are acting on these rumours and presumably what they're hearing. One of the things they hear is that these two disappearances are linked, right? The ones we've talked about, Dean and Leah.
Yeah, well, ultimately that's the view they come to.
Okay.
And so it's quite a long extrapolated story as how they got to that point. But certainly in the first instance, they began looking at these rumours and they began speaking to a wide range of people about what they knew. And pressure was being put on some people, and a couple of different people had mentioned Stephen Stone's potential involvement, and so police really zeroed in on him as the focus of their investigations.
And when did this this other associate, Gail Maney, when did her name become attached to these cases?
Well, it really wasn't until sort of late 1997, early 1998, her name was thrown in the mix. She had, for a brief time in 1989, associated with Stephen Stone. Her and some of her friends had. He was certainly known to them, and they came into the frame through their connection to him. But over the course of a period of months, she became the focus of more and more attention from the police, her and two or three other women in particular, as well as a couple of men.
And so what did the police conclude had happened?
Ultimately, the Crown case at trial was that that 10 people had been present in a garage in Larnach Road in Henderson, and that Gail Maney had a vendetta against Dean Fuller Sands for a supposed burglary he'd committed on their house some weeks earlier, and she had instructed or directed Stephen Stone to deal with them. And the Crown case is that as a result of that order from Gail, a group of people got together in a suburban garage one afternoon and repeatedly shot Dean Fuller Sands.
It's pretty different to the first explanation, isn't it?
Very different, very different. It's an incredibly complex story, but essentially four people were charged with involvement in that scenario. Another four people were secret witnesses for the police and gave evidence, two men, two women. And the other two people, one was Dean Fuller Sands, and the other person was a woman called Leah Stevens, who we've previously discussed. What the Crown case was that as a result of the shooting of Dean and his burial and taking his car out to Whodapu and sort of trying to stage this scenario that he'd been watched off the rocks, the Crown case was that Leah Stevens started getting windy about what she'd seen, what she'd witnessed, was potentially going to talk to the police. And so as a result of that, the Crown case was that Stephen Stone and two others had her disposed of.
And by the way, back to that car that had been found at Whatipu, any forensic DNA evidence on that car, fingerprints?
No, there was nothing on that car pointing to murder at all. There was some suggestion that the vehicle had been moved at some stage when Dean was supposedly out there. But a really crucial piece of evidence that the jury got to hear about was that Dean had a very particular way that he placed a cloth over a part of his car. And when the car was found, that cloth was in that position.
Okay.
And so I think that's, you know, it's a small piece of evidence, but potentially quite compelling.
Yeah. And we're getting to one of the hardest parts of this case, which is that there is no evidence really, right? There's no body, there's not much forensics. All we have is the varying accounts of various people, most of whom have some sort of criminal history or connection to each other or connection to prison. It's pretty hard unpacking the truth from that. And they change as well, these stories.
It really is. And, you know, there's not a scrap of forensic evidence. It was several years later that the police identified this address in Larnach Road as the potential scene of this shooting. You know, this scenario, when you read it and hear about it, is quite extraordinary, where a group of nine people stand around and execute somebody and repeatedly shoot them. You know, there was never any reports of gunfire. It was a suburban street. There's no evidence of that. There was no forensic evidence. There was no blood. There was nothing to support this theory. There was no marks that might have been made by bullets flying around this rather small garage.
Quite a convenient sort of explanation too, if it was true that he had been murdered, that the murderer would chance upon a guy who was on his way fishing, had all his fishing gear in the back, and happened to be going to a dangerous, isolated beach, you know, where that other alternative explanation was open to them.
Yeah, that's right. And so at its very best, the Crown case is quite extraordinary, even on their own account. But when you look at what the convictions lie on, and ultimately four people were convicted of involvement, they rely heavily on the evidence of four people, two women, two men, but all of whom have name suppression. And some of them have done various things to protect their identities, understandably. But two of those witnesses have now retracted that evidence. The two women have retracted their evidence and said none of this ever happened. It didn't happen. It was made up. We were put under a great deal of pressure by the police to say these things. So the convictions now lean only on the two men who gave that evidence.
I'm speaking with Tim McKinnell, who's an investigator, a private investigator, who's looked at this Gail Maney case, the so-called gone fishing case. And interestingly, police have this theory as to why Gail had a vendetta against Dean, who was killed. She says she never even met him. That's pretty different as well, right?
Yeah, incredibly different. And so we have the two women who've retracted their evidence and said none of it ever happened. We were put under a great deal of pressure by the police. Gail Maney says the same thing. She says the police pressure was incredible. And if you accept Gail's position, and I do, then she was able to withstand that pressure. She was told very clearly, you either work with us or you're in the dock. Well, she refused to accept the police, what the police wanted her to say, and ultimately she ended up in the dock and in prison, where, you know, she's back there again today. So it's pretty scary stuff. There are a number of things that we've identified. We've got a small team of people working on it. Julianne Kincaid, QC, is Gail's lawyer. She works out of Blackstone Chambers and has a team working on it. And I'm working with Meg Durand and Katja Paquin at my office. And it is an extraordinarily difficult task working through the evidence. But one of the things that's really emerged for us is there are really strong gender themes. So we have three women telling fairly consistent stories about the pressure they were put under and the threats that were made against them to say the things they said. Well, two of them said what the police wanted, and Gail withstood that pressure. And so we're looking very closely at what they are telling us about the things that were said to them to give the evidence that they gave.
So what do you mean by pressure?
Well, for example, all three of them say and have said independently that one of the threats that was made to them that was the custody of their children. Now, they weren't angels at the time. In 1989, they were all leading relatively adventurous lives, if you want to use a euphemism. But they had children and felt vulnerable to those threats. They would lose custody of their children if they didn't cooperate with police, was one example. There were regular visits, and they were told that you're either with us, against us, or against us, basically. Now, it's important to note that that this has been raised before, and some of the police officers involved have denied that they put pressure on. But in the podcast Gone Fishing that I think did a brilliant job of setting the case out, there were some admissions from Mark Franklin, the officer in charge of the case, and he made it clear in that yes, absolutely, witnesses were put under pressure. So I guess the question is how much pressure is appropriate.
And when you look at the statements of witnesses or so-called witnesses, do you see them sort of change, solidify, fall into line over time?
Well, the two women who have since retracted their evidence, you look at their evidence and it changed dramatically at different times. And, you know, the reasons for that, they tell us, are that they were being told what to say. And on occasions, they were put in rooms together where they were able to compare notes about what their evidence was to be. We look at the men's evidence, who's really the only evidence left against the four people that were convicted, and they told an extraordinary number of accounts, different versions, completely contradictory in places. One of them told somewhere between 9 and 12 different versions of events before they settled on what the Crown case was. And, you know, I think in that context, we need to remember that both of those men, and I don't think I've touched on this before, were given immunity from prosecution for the rape and murder of Leah Stevens. Essentially, they admitted involvement in her rape and murder and walked away scot-free.
On the understanding that they would provide, that they would corroborate the police's version of what happened in the previous murder.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, I guess that the argument could be made that they qualified for that if they weren't primary offenders. But when you look at immunity from prosecution, I think our team is certainly forming the view that that should only be offered to people that are credible. When you're talking about 5, 7, 9, 12 different versions of events, I'm not sure that you can make the claim that they're credible witnesses.
Tell me about the lead investigator.
Well, Mark Franklin led the investigation. He was a relatively high profile investigator in West Auckland throughout the 90s. And he ran into trouble himself in the years after he left the police. He's been convicted in the Cook Islands of drug dealing. We don't place too much emphasis on that. I mean, but one of the things he admitted, which I thought was fascinating in the podcast, the Gone Fishing podcast, was that he was regularly using cannabis throughout this investigation and other investigations as a means for coping with some of the stresses of the job. And, you know, without wanting to make moral judgments about that, it calls into question his judgment around gangs, around drug dealers, around potentially prostitutes. All of these were facets of the investigation that he was managing. And so a question arises about whether he was compromised in those areas, but also around his judgment. If he thought it was appropriate to break the law because it suited him at that time, what else was he prepared to do?
Have you heard from him in the course of your investigation?
We haven't spoken to him yet. The only words we've heard from him really are what he said in the podcast. I think eventually we'll approach him and see if he'll speak to us.
Mm. You mentioned, so I think there were four witnesses, or so-called witnesses, to events. Two of them were women who have recanted their stories, and then two men who I think have stuck to their stories, except a former police officer's come forward to say one of them said that he'd been lying about the evidence he gave. Is that right?
No. Well, there's mixed evidence around those two men, and I probably don't want to talk too much about them because it's a sensitive area in terms of our work. But we have had former police officers come forward and talk to us about various parts of the investigation, and we've had some concerns expressed. One of the reasons we're talking publicly about the case now is there are a handful of people who know a great deal about this case that could help us, and that could help the truth emerge, in my view.
And what sorts of people?
Well, people that were mixing with these people, potentially police officers. I think there are at least a couple of police officers that are deeply uncomfortable with some of what went on, and we'd like them to come forward and talk to us on the record. And, you know, in terms of what happened to Leah Stevens, we've got another working theory. You know, if Dean Fuller Sands wasn't killed in the garage like the Crown case says, then there is no motive for Stephen Stone and the two other men to have hurt her. And if that's true, then what happened to her? We've got some working theories about what might have happened to her, and we're exploring those.
What's driving you, by the way?
Well, it's fascinating work. It's interesting work. Miscarriages,
presumably unpaid work.
No, we're very fortunate. We have some legal aid funding. It took a while to come through in Tana Porter's case, but I think there is broadly an acceptance with legal aid now that sometimes these cases are worth funding. Mm. And so we have some legal aid funding to do the work that we're doing.
Great.
And it's an important that we do have that.
One thing I wanted to mention is, according to this second account of what happened to Dean, they all went out and buried him in the woods, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So could anyone lead police to a body or where it was buried?
Well, you'd think they could, wouldn't you? But they couldn't. My view is that these men took police on a wild goose chase. There was days and probably tens of thousands of dollars spent searching for the burial spot, the supposed burial spot, and of course it was never found. And our view of that is because the very original story about Dean being swept off the rocks is the true one. Mm. And that if that is true, then the scale of the lies that have been told are something that I don't think this country has ever seen before.
Lies told by
by these witnesses,
yeah.
by these two male witnesses.
Okay.
I mean, that is what the Crown case rests on solely now. And if what they have said is a pack of lies, then it's quite extraordinary what has unfolded from those lies.
Namely, the imprisonment of two people?
Conviction of four people, imprisonment of two people. Both of those people are presently in prison for this crime. And, you know, if it's a crime that never was, then that's an extraordinary injustice. It's, you know, it's one thing to be in prison for a crime that did happen. It's quite another to be in prison for a crime that never happened.
And Stephen Stone, who is the person that Gail Maney allegedly ordered to do this execution, have you spoken to him?
I have.
Can he help her out?
Yes, he's not our client, but I have spoken to him, and it's he maintains his innocence, and it's not my place to speak on his behalf. But it's absolutely clear from Gail's instructions that that what the Crown said happened didn't happen, and that's consistent with my conversation with Stephen Stone.
So Gail Maney was convicted once in 1999. And was there an appeal or for some reason for a retrial?
Yeah, this is another curious thing about the case. There was an appeal. There was a judgment after the first trial, and Stephen Stone and Gail Maney, one of the other suspects, not Stephen Stone, and Gail Maney got a second trial and were convicted again. Gail appealed again in 2005, so the second trial was in 2000. Gail appealed in 2005, and unfortunately, one of the Court of Appeal judges that sat on that appeal was the original trial judge from the first trial. And I personally have some difficulty with that. He was criticised in having Gail's first conviction quashed, and here he was popping up 6 years later as a Court of Appeal judge on her case.
Okay. It must happen a bit, I suppose.
Well, it probably does.
Yeah. Just doesn't look very good. Can you compare this to Taina Porter? We covered the Taina Porter case, I think it was last week, on this New Zealand Crime feature, and you were involved in that as well. Similarities for you?
Similarities in some respects in terms of, in my view, gross injustice. But quite different cases, although, from a similar time period. And I think if we look at some of the history of our wrongful conviction cases, a period from sort of 1980 through to the late 1990s, where I think there's some real problems with some of the convictions that were entered for quite serious crimes. And so in that respect, both Taina's and Gail's cases have similarities in terms of interview techniques and police approaches to evidence and those sorts of things.
By the way, on what grounds were her appeals granted? Anything of interest?
Quite technical, rather than claims as we're now claiming of actual innocence, so around fair trial issues.
Okay. So she served her time and was released?
Yeah, well, as a murderer, she was convicted murderer. She was sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum non-parole period. She's been released a couple of times and recalled. I went and saw her in prison this week and had a chat to her, and she's pretty open, Gail. I mean, she was involved in the podcast, and we talked about the fact that she's been recalled again. I think it's fair to say that life, like it wasn't for Taina and isn't for Taina, it's not easy for her. And so she's had some struggles, but she's keen to get back out again. She's got a parole hearing coming up in a few weeks now that she's been recalled, and her instructions to us are to try and get her out if we can.
Mm. What's a recall? It's when you're out on parole and you break some condition or
you
something.
You breach a condition, yeah. And so probation have deemed that she's breached a condition, and she's been recalled on that. The parole board will have a hearing to listen to what she has to say about what's been alleged.
Mm. I mean, Taina Porter had a happy ending, really. I mean, a complicated happy ending. But, he was found to be innocent.
Yes.
Got some compensation, is now free. And so what are the chances that this will happen to Gail as well?
Well, we're hopeful. I mean, it's not lost on us that what we're alleging and what Gail is alleging is an extraordinary miscarriage. I mean, it's not going to be easy to prove all these years later. But we wouldn't be, our team wouldn't be throwing ourselves into this if we weren't confident that that we have strong grounds to and a real opportunity to prove her complete innocence.
What strategies do you have now? You mentioned that if you can find another reason or perhaps perpetrator of that other murder, it sort of unravels the whole police theory on the Dean murder. That's no doubt one of them, but are you appealing for any other sort of appeal or pardon?
We've got one of the witnesses has come forward and retracted, and that's new and fresh evidence, and we think pretty compelling evidence that's consistent with earlier evidence that had been dismissed. So we have that, and there's a couple of other pieces of evidence we're developing. I think we've analysed the evidence that was before the courts in a way that hasn't been done before, and I think we can demonstrate some things to the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court or wherever we go in a way that's never been done before. It's when you unpack it properly, it's an extraordinary case in every sense, and I think we're reasonably confident we're on the right track.
Mm. Anything we haven't covered? Or are we up to date?
No, I think we're up to date on the big points. It's an extraordinary case. It's going to take a while, but I think we've covered most of it. Again, I would reiterate that people will know things about the case, and if they do, they should come and talk to us. Mm. And they can do so confidentially to begin with if they want to test the waters.
So long ago, eh?
Yeah, it's a long time ago, and we need to be really alert to the fragility of human memories. And that's something we're conscious of in terms of managing witnesses.
Mm. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jason.
Tim McKinnell. Now, I meant to ask you one other question, which was how did it get known as the body in the boot case?
It's the Crown case that after Dean was shot, he was put in the boot of a car.
Right,
and
okay.
His own, and driven out and buried.
Yeah, and the car in question. Mm. Okay. Thanks very much, Tim McKinnell. And if you missed the start of that, you can listen back to it on demand. And if you're really interested, of course, you can listen to the podcast. It's an award-winning podcast and has a huge reputation. It's called Gone Fishing, and it was a joint effort by Stuff and RNZ.